This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents Clapton, The Autobiography by Eric Clapton. Read by Simon Vance. Hazelden, Picking Up the Pieces. I called Roger rather than Patty on that fateful day because he had become the most important person in my life. More than anybody, he was the one who had seen me in all my different conditions, and who had also pronounced with absolute certainty what no one else had had the nerve to tell me, that I was an alcoholic. He had obviously been researching the subject for some time, because he had already booked me into Hazelden, which was then said to be the best treatment centre for alcoholics in the world. I had no idea where it was, and didn't really care. My only stipulation was that I didn't want to know when I was going until the last moment. On the day we left, a cold January morning in 1982, Roger picked me up from Hurtwood and took me to Gatwick Airport. I was a bag of nerves. He flew with me on a Northwest Orient flight to Minneapolis, St. Paul, the scene of my ulcer treatment only 6 months previously. On the flight over, I drank the plane dry. So terrified was I that I might never be able to drink again. This is the most common fear of alcoholics. In the lowest moments of my life, the only reason I didn't commit suicide was that I knew I wouldn't be able to drink any more if I was dead. It was the only thing I thought was worth living for, and the idea that people were about to try and remove me from alcohol was so terrible that I drank and drank and drank, and they had to practically carry me into the clinic. Hazelden turned out to be in Center City, in the middle of nowhere, northeast of Minneapolis-St. Paul. The nearest town was a one-horse place called St. Croix. The clinic itself looked grim and resembled Fort Knox, its low concrete buildings giving it the appearance of a high-security prison. It didn't surprise me to learn that when they tried to get Elvis to go there, he apparently took one look at it and refused to get out of his limo. Most of the new arrivals were either drunk, like I was, or dying for a drink, or possibly comatose due to the amount of alcohol in their system and in need of immediate detoxification. They wouldn't even let me bring in my guitar. All I wanted to do when I saw the place was run away. After checking in, I spent the first week in the hospital part of the clinic, where most new inmates go because they're usually seriously addicted and have to be withdrawn medically. I was given a drug called Librium, which helps you come off the alcohol and balances you out. It left me feeling very woozy. I didn't really know who I was or who the other people were or what I was doing there. It was all just like being heroin-stoned again. 4 times a day I was given my medicine in a little paper cup, and gradually they weaned me off booze. Before you start, you're asked to write down a list of everything you've been taking, and since they often don't have any medical records of new patients, they have to rely on your honesty. Of all the things I had been using, I neglected to include Valium on the list, because I considered that to be a ladies' drug. The result was that I suffered another grand mal seizure because they hadn't medicated me for Valium withdrawal. I later learned that this can be a very dangerous drug indeed, and is highly underestimated. The clinic, founded in 1949, was divided up into a series of units, each one named after a famous person connected with the 12-step program. Mine was Silkworth, after William Silkworth, a New York doctor who is quoted in the Big Book of AA. The unit was divided into a living area, a small kitchen, and lots of little rooms, shared by 2 to 4 people. They had all been through the same as me, the new boy bouncing off the ceiling, and for the first few days they looked after me. I was put into a room with a New York fireman named Tommy, who had no idea who I was, and didn't care. He was more concerned with the way I interacted with him on a personal level, and I had no idea how to do that, because I was either above or below everybody. I was either towering above as Clapton the guitar virtuoso, or cringing on the floor, because if he took away my guitar and my musical career, then I was nothing. My fear of loss of identity was phenomenal. This could have been born out of the Clapton is God thing, which had put so much of my self-worth onto my musical career. When the focus shifted toward my well-being as a human being, and to the realization that I was an alcoholic, and suffering from the same disease everybody else was, I went into meltdown. At first I basically withdrew. My counselor and most of the other people concerned with me all reported that I was playing a game in not revealing anything of myself at all, but I think I'd forgotten how, and had little ability to account for myself without my guitar. For over 20 years I had been attached to this partner that gave me my power and my accountability, and without it I didn't have anything to refer to. I didn't know how to begin to relate, so I just sort of shifted around in the background. Then part of my reasoning began to figure out just how much I needed to do in order to get through my time and reach a successful conclusion so that I could leave, just like everybody else. I knew, because they dangled this threat in front of you, if at the end of the standard 1 month period you were not seen to be ready to be released back into society because you were still in the grip of your addiction, whatever it might be, they would recommend that you be transferred to the psychiatric unit, called Jelinek, which involved all kinds of medication and extended care. Like all the units, Silkworth held 28 people and basically ran itself, though there were a couple of counsellors in situ to keep an eye on everybody and make sure that nothing got out of control. Everyone was accountable, and you weren't supposed to do anything unethical or abusive. We were expected to be honest and supportive, love one another, and act with decorum, things I wanted to do without being sure how to go about it. The fact is, it was the first time I'd been in a proper democratic community situation in my entire life. The closest I'd ever come to one was when I was hanging out with the guys in Longacre, and we would have group sessions getting stoned. In those first few days I really didn't know how to communicate, and I felt quite frightened. I chose to think of myself as shy again, and developed a stutter. Once it was considered that I could stand on my own 2 feet, I was given tasks to do, the simplest being to make my own bed, which I'd never done before, and keep myself and my surroundings clean and tidy. Then I was given the job of setting the table for my unit before mealtimes, quite a task for someone who lacked any experience at doing anything domestic. Each group had a hierarchy, consisting of a leader and a caretaker, known as the pig master, whose responsibility was to make sure everyone did their duties. There was little chance of skiving off, and if I had done so, the pig master would have been after me. The day began with prayers, followed by breakfast, and was then filled with activities such as group therapy sessions, lectures, psychological tests, and exercise interspersed with mealtimes, all designed to keep you occupied until you collapsed into bed at the end of the day in a state of mental exhaustion. Sleep came easily, which for me, who had always had to drink to sleep, was great. At first, the thing that scared me the most was group therapy, where we were encouraged to confront one another about our day-to-day behaviour inside the unit. I had never learned to look honestly at myself. In fact, in order to protect my drinking, it was important not to do that. So here I was, feeling raw and vulnerable, wondering how I could even begin to get in touch with the person I had become. But that's what we were there for, and there was no getting around it. The purpose of group therapy seemed to be for us to see, through direct interaction with one another, the kind of people we had become, and to help one another identify the symptoms of our disease by honestly recognizing the shared defects of the group. Denial seemed to head the list, followed by self-centeredness, pride, and dishonesty. I found that it had become almost impossible to be honest, especially with myself. Lying and deflection had become second nature to me. But hanging above all this was the big question. Had I truly accepted that I was an alcoholic? Because until I did, progress would be difficult. The struggle of doing this kind of internal work unaided was unthinkable, which is why group therapy was really necessary. We helped each other, sometimes with brutal means, to discover who we really were. After about 10 days, I began to enjoy being there. I looked around and saw some amazing people, sometimes real hardliners who had been in Hazelden 4 or 5 times and had much worse stories to tell than I did. I started to bond with my inmates, and I remember laughing and laughing for the first time in years. We had a coffee pot on the go all day long, and you'd get coffeed out, sitting up into the night talking about ourselves, our ambitions, and the things we had lost. It was a very rich and loving experience. Most days we heard really inspirational lectures given by people who had had a long time in recovery, who would usually just tell their story. Sometimes they'd highlight certain aspects of recovery, like honesty and denial. But they always emphasized how great life was now that they were sober. And you knew it wasn't bullshit. At other times the lectures would take a scientific slant, depicting the nature of the disease in its different phases. It was really good, if not essential, for me to learn, for instance, that alcoholism was regarded, at least in America, as a disease, and not a form of moral degeneracy. It was a huge relief to know that I was suffering from a recognized medical condition no more shameful than diabetes. It made me feel less alone. These talks riveted me, and I got really excited by some of the personalities who came, people who had been sober for 20 years or more and had stories to tell that were often hair-raising and sometimes tragic. But some of us were hard to reach, and I heard later that there was quite a lot of drug-taking going on in my unit. Sundays were family visitation days, and this is when substances could be smuggled in by friends or family. I didn't do anything myself, only because I didn't know anyone who would bring me anything. My problem was of a different kind. Hazelden was not a single-sex institution, but fraternization between the sexes was strictly forbidden, and patients were expected to report anybody seen doing this. But flirtation was a daily practice, and attempted liaisons were fairly common. I did manage to have a couple of dalliances with girls without being caught. I achieved this by somehow persuading my counselor that I was entitled to a room of my own, and once I got this, I set about trying to get girls to come and visit me. I succeeded, but only at risk to other people who knew it was happening. If they had been found out for not reporting me, we would all have been thrown out. Hazelden was one of the first clinics to have a family program, and toward the end of my stay, Patty flew out to undergo a 5-day course designed to teach spouses and family members what to expect, and how to reapproach their relationships when the patient finally returned home, hopefully sober. It also encouraged them to look at their own role in the family structure, to see whether there would be a possible need for them to get help as well. It has become generally accepted in these matters that no one holds a gun to the head of a person involved with an alcoholic. They are almost invariably there for their own reasons, and in many cases this is because they are addicted themselves, even if it's only in a caretaking fashion. If this is the case, their foundations are often shaken and their roles threatened when the addict takes steps toward recovery because they can no longer practice their own addiction with satisfactory results. The Hazelden Family Program, among other things, focused on the need for family members to look really honestly at the nature of their relationships and learn how they could identify and, if necessary, redirect their own needs in order to share their lives successfully with someone who didn't need looking after anymore. For Patty, these sessions were to prove incredibly helpful, not least because she got to meet other people who were in the same situation that she was. I think she felt she had been acting as a surrogate mother most of her life, starting with her siblings and continuing the role in her relationships. In her life with me, I think she yearned for an independent identity, but was rarely allowed to account for herself because I was always the focus of attention. For years all she would hear was, "What are we going to do about Eric?" or, "Eric's such an annoyance. Eric's done this, Eric's done that. Isn't he wonderful? Isn't he awful?" Until she came to Hazelden, nobody ever asked her, "Well, who are you? And what's your reason for being with him?" Of course, at times I felt I'd never make it through the whole month, and some did give up. One very wealthy guy actually had his wife fly a helicopter into a nearby field and left in the middle of the night. I got through what was to be the first of 2 visits to Hazelden by what I later learned was called tap dancing. I figured out exactly what it was I thought they needed from me, and I gave it to them. I also watched the counselors very carefully and tried to mimic them, going to other people in the unit and trying to work out their problems to deflect attention from myself. The result was that I finally got to the end of my stay, having done just enough of the required work to be released. One of the features about Hazelden was their very good aftercare program. Before I even left my unit, they had contacted AA in the area where I lived and organized a sponsor to meet me. I was assigned a man who lived in Dorking named David. It was recommended I stay with my first given sponsor until I had a little time under my belt, and then maybe choose another, based on what my requirements were. It was widely pointed out, by the way, that I would be the last person to know what those requirements were. It was also impressed upon me that it was not a good idea to make any great decisions, or embark on any momentous voyages of work, for about a year. This was supposedly to allow time for my head to clear, and also gradually be reintroduced to reality. I did the opposite, of course. Before that, however, I had to face the problems of integrating myself with the people at home. I remember that I had a friend there, one of my drinking partners, whom I didn't know that well, but every weekend he would come down from Chessington, and we would go out boozing round the local pubs. It usually started at the Windmill on Saturday mornings, so the first Saturday I got back from America, he turned up as usual. He had no idea where I had been, and I realized that this would be one of the first times I was going to have to tell anybody about it. I was naturally nervous, but I came out of the house and said to him, "Look, I'm afraid I can't go up to the pub. I've stopped drinking." He looked at me curiously for a minute, and then said, "Well, fuck you," and got into his car and drove off. I never saw him again. I don't think for a minute there was any malevolence in his reaction. That was just a normal conversation for us, but in a way it prepared me for the kind of reaction I probably could expect from some quarters, especially old drinking buddies. Most of the Ripleyites, like Guy Pullen, my oldest and truest friend, were proud of what I'd achieved, but this didn't mean they were going to temper their drinking just to accommodate me. So I had to make some fairly tough choices. Certain people, places, and things were dangerous for me, and I needed to carefully identify what was safe and what wasn't safe for my sobriety from a long list of past associations and haunts. But my judgment was useless, and my value system was completely upside down. What had previously been number 1, 2, and 3 on my list of life priorities, excitement, danger, and risk, now had no place there at all. For a while I tried to associate only with people who would be good for me, but it was hard. I was angry and disagreeable, and I didn't know what to do with all the time that I used to spend drinking. I went to 12-step meetings, sometimes 5 or 6 a week, and would sit there thinking, "I'm not like these people. I don't really belong here." What I needed was someone to take an interest in me. But now I was just Eric the alcoholic, and I wasn't too sure that I had totally accepted that. Among the hardest things I had to face on my return from Hazelden was attempting to re-enter my relationship with Patty. I came back from treatment with no real idea of how to open the door of intimacy again. It was not something we had covered in treatment, and I regret that now. Not that I think it would have made any difference for us, although that is debatable, but because it is a very real issue and ought to be included in all programs of this nature. Suffice to say, we didn't know what to do. It had been so long since I had done anything without booze, I just didn't know where to start. It was heartbreaking for both of us. Patty had been so looking forward to having this clean young man coming home to her, and here I was, partially broken, like a Vietnam vet. I would go to bed with her and just curl up beside her in the fetal position. I was ashamed and didn't want to talk about it, because for me the foundations of our relationship had been built on sex, and I just assumed that it would all just fall into place the minute I got home. About this time I started to blame Patty for everything. After all, hadn't I got sober for her? Where was her gratitude? That was how I was beginning to think. She, meanwhile, was perfectly capable of drinking wine and doing coke in moderation, and to a certain extent wanted to carry on with our old lifestyle, and who could blame her? But I had to practice abstinence, and for me, sobriety was becoming a drudge. I missed drinking and was jealous of her for being able to do all that stuff in moderation. I still had not really accepted the truth about myself. The cracks in our relationship caused me to withdraw into myself. I began to spend a lot of time fishing, though for many years I had been a novice fisherman, fishing primarily for perch, carp, and pike in the waters round Ripley. Gary Brooker had recently taught me to cast a fly. Pike fishing is a cumbersome affair compared to trout fishing. There's an awful lot of gear to cart around, baskets full of stuff, rod stands and so on, and green thermal suits to wear. And then when you get out there, you don't really do very much, just sit and wait. And I used to look at Gary with amusement, with his little bag with some flies in it and a rod and reel. I mean, he could walk around with this kit so easily. One day he gave me a lesson in casting on his lawn, and once I got the line to go straight out for more than 10 feet, I began to think of it as a skill, one that maybe I could master. That first summer of my recovery was one of the most beautiful I can remember, perhaps because I was healthy and clean, and I began to rent some trout fishing days for myself, mostly on stretches of water in the neighbourhood that had been specially stocked for local fishermen. I fished on the Clandon estate, and on the lakes at Willinghurst, and at Whitley Farm near Dunsfold. Fishing is an absorbing pastime, and has a zen quality to it. It's an ideal pursuit for anyone who wants to think a lot, and get things in perspective. It was also a perfect way of getting physically fit again, involving, as it does, a great deal of walking. I would go out at the crack of dawn and often stay out till night-time, sometimes proudly returning with a bag of fish that I would present to Patty to clean and cook. For once, I was actually becoming good at something that had nothing to do with guitar playing or music. For the first time in a long time, I was doing something very normal and fairly mundane, and it was really important to me. However, the fact that it was increasing Patty's sense of isolation passed me by. Believing that work would be one of my greatest therapies, I went on tour with my English band within 4 months of coming out of Hazeldon. It was totally against what the counsellors had recommended, and I imagine they're used to that, but it was a rash decision. The fact is, I wasn't yet ready for work. The first time I stood on stage, at the Paramount Theatre in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, I thought to myself, "This sounds awful," and I didn't really know why. Like my problem with sex, I hadn't played sober for a long time, and had been used to hearing everything through a veil of alcohol and drug distortion, and I just couldn't get used to the sound without it. I went all around America without really knowing what I was doing, but I did go to meetings. At the last show in Miami, Muddy Waters made a guest appearance, and we played Blow, Wind, Blow together. It was the last time I got to play with him, as he died in April the following year. On our return from this tour, we went into Compass Point Studios in the Bahamas to cut tracks for a new album. The songs had a pub rock feel to them, and to me, this was a continuation of what I'd been involved in with Ronnie Lane. In the beginning, I was happy playing with these guys. We were doing it for fun and companionship and the love of music, all of which seemed to me to be the right reasons. But Roger wasn't too sure, and neither was Tom, who was producing again, and to be fair to them, after 2 weeks of this, we'd hardly completed one track. An atmosphere of apprehension spread over the studio, and it looked like we might not make the album at all. Also, Gary Brooker and I had become very close, and as a result he was having a lot of input into the way the band worked, which, for whatever reason, was not popular with management and production. After a couple of weeks, Tom Dowd came to me and laid it on the line that nothing was going to happen with this new album unless we had a radical change of musicians. He recommended that I fire the current band, with the exception of Albert Lee, and that we start again from scratch. He added that he could get legendary session musicians Donald Duck Dunn and Roger Hawkins to come and stand in, and even told me that Ry Cooder was interested in coming down. He said if I wasn't prepared to do the firing myself, then he would do it for me. I was excited by the names he'd mentioned, people I'd held in high esteem for years, and I decided to take this fork in the road. In my drinking days, I would have got Roger to do my dirty work, but I had learned from my time at Hazeldon that I needed to start taking responsibility in these matters. That night I had dinner with the band members and told them, "I'm very sorry, but I've got bad news. This just isn't working, and it's been suggested to me that I try something else. So I'm asking you all to go home, and I'll let any of you know if I want you to come back to play on tour." A stunned silence fell over us when I told them. Sacking the band was a huge thing for me to do, and very painful. For Henry Spinetti and Gary Brooker, the wounds took a long time to mend, and I've never seen Dave Marquis since. As for Chris Stainton, he was the lucky one who got rehired, and has been at my side ever since. Firing them personally had a positive effect on me in that it established my ability to take control over my working life, which previously had been totally in the hands of Roger. It also triggered a mini-breakdown. The pressure to complete this album, my first since emerging from alcoholism, was enormous, and it had to be good. We had one more song to complete, and at some point I just broke down with Tom, sobbing my heart out in front of him. I think as much as anything else I was grieving the loss of my relationship with alcohol, which was very powerful, and an emotion I had not hitherto sufficiently acknowledged. It had been my first relationship and subsequently played a hugely significant part in my life. I called the album Money and Cigarettes, because that's all that I saw myself having left. When we had the playback party with Tom, Roger, Patty, and a few other people, what would normally be, I suppose, for most artists, a joyous celebration, seemed more like a wake. There was definitely something forced about the album, and when we went on the road with it through most of 1983, it was a bit of an anticlimax. I think subconsciously, part of me was rebelling, telling me that all I really wanted to do was play music I loved, with people I loved and cared for. This really struck home when I became involved in the ARMS, Action Research into Multiple Sclerosis, concerts at the end of the year. This was a series of charity concerts organized by Glyn Johns to benefit research into MS, a disease that had recently struck down Ronnie Lane. Over the years that I had stayed with Ronnie in Wales, I had noticed that his playing style was becoming more and more erratic, until he was almost just strumming the air in front of the guitar without actually hitting the strings. I had no idea what that was all about, until now, when it all suddenly made sense. Ronnie had found somebody who could give him hyperbaric treatments, which involved being put into a decompression chamber, and this would alleviate his symptoms and make life bearable for him for quite long periods of time. It was expensive, however, so Glyn had come up with the idea of gathering together a group of musician friends and holding a concert to raise money for him. Steve Winwood, Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, Bill Wyman, Charlie Watts, Kenny Jones, and Andy Fairweather Lowe all rallied to the cause, and after a few days of practice at Glyn's house, we put on a show at the Royal Albert Hall. It was a fantastic success, with a terrific atmosphere. We were all playing together for the first time, and because we were doing it for Ronnie rather than for money, we left our egos at the door, and it was a blast. In fact, we enjoyed ourselves so much that it was decided that if everyone would agree, we should take the show on the road to try to make a lot of money for ARMS. The result was a successful tour of America, playing 20,000-seat arenas in Dallas, San Francisco, L.A., and New York, with all of us having a thoroughly great time. Relapse. Reflecting on the years after I came out of Hazelden, I now realize that there was no reason for me to be making records at all. A more intelligent approach to rebuilding my life would have been to leave recording for a while to try something else, and spend a few years finding out what it was that I really wanted to do, rather than just step back into the accepted pattern from the past. But that was not to be. Whether the pressures were contractual or habitual is irrelevant, as I was back on the treadmill looking for another formula for a successful album. Roger's suggestion was a collaboration with Phil Collins, who was riding high at the time. Though I wasn't a fan of Genesis, Phil and I had become good friends over the years, a friendship strengthened during the breakup of his marriage to his first wife, Andrea, when he used to come over to Hurtwood and pour his heart out to Patty and me. I had even played guitar on If Leaving Me Is Easy, a track on his first album, Face Value. Though at first Roger's plan just seemed like a pretty obvious marketing ploy, in the end I decided it wasn't such a bad idea. It did mean, however, that I would have to come up with some new material when I wasn't really ready to. While considering the best way to go about this, I remembered a trip I had made to Wales many years before when I had gone there alone with my dog and stayed in the Borders for a couple of weeks and had the time of my life. It seemed like that might be a good place to return to, so I got Nigel Carroll to go and find me a cottage in the area. He rented a place near Beulah, in the Brecon Beacons, and I went up there with some recording equipment and started writing. Actually, I spent most of my time chopping wood, as all the hot water and the central heating system came from a back boiler heated by the fire. The cottage was miles from anywhere, and I hardly ever spoke to anyone. I go to the pub and have a lemonade and a cheese sandwich, and nobody even looked at me. It was very odd. Until I started trying to write this new material, I had no idea how difficult it was going to be to shift myself away from writing just for me. I would complete a song and play it back and feel happy with it, and then I'd be out in my car and one of Phil's hits would come on the radio, and I'd think, "My God, I'm nowhere near this kind of stuff." It was hard trying to fit into his mould. On my return from Wales, I called Phil and told him I had a few new songs and we decided to go and work on them in George Martin's Air Studios in Montserrat, in the Caribbean. The idea was to jam a little, try out my songs, see if we could write something together and maybe do some covers. Knock on Wood was one I was keen to try. I had the same band, except that Jamie Oldacre had replaced Roger Hawkins on drums, and Phil had also brought in Peter Robinson to play synthesizer, a new direction for me. We were soon having a great time, and the plan was working. Between now, 12 midnight, and yesterday, I wrote in my diary on March 12, 1984, we've got 5 great tracks. Phil is so great to work with, you get so much done, but it doesn't feel like hard work at all. Peter Robinson is a genius and a great bloke too. In fact, the whole thing is going so great, I hope it never stops. I was amazed by how much we were achieving, and I thought the sound was incredible. Good old Phil, I wrote the following day. He's a diamond, all right. Only one thing jarred. There seemed to be a kind of conspiracy to keep me from knowing that all the guys were boozing and doing a lot of blow. It was happening in secret, and it was as if they didn't trust me to handle it. I became very angry. Somebody's been holding out on me, I told them. I'm not a kid. I want to know everything that's going on. But when I voiced my disquiet, they just kind of shouted at me in a joking way and said, "But you don't do it anymore." Before I left home, my attendance at 12-step meetings had dropped, and I had neglected to find out if there were any where I was going. On my arrival, I had noticed that in the kitchen of the chalet I was staying in was a courtesy gift of a bottle of local rum on the sideboard, but instead of picking it up and deliberately pouring it all down the drain, I just put it away in a cupboard, thinking, I'm not going to overreact to this by throwing it down the sink. I'll just put it somewhere where I can't see it. But one night, soon after my row with the band, I went to a club on the far side of the island, where I convinced myself that it would be all right to have a couple of drinks. I then went back to my chalet and polished off the bottle of rum in one sitting. As a celebration, the next day I set about seducing the manager of the studio, Yvonne, a beautiful lady from Doncaster whose father was a Montserratian guitar player. She was very witty and funny, a dark-haired, flirtatious beauty who seemed to be interested, and next thing I knew we were embarked on a very passionate and reckless affair, taking no precautions whatsoever. Like the drinking, my rationale was, nobody will know. We're miles away from anywhere. At the same time, it's as if I wanted to get caught doing something that would rock the domestic boat at home. My disillusionment with my marriage was touched on in some of the songs I had written for the new album, like She's Waiting, Just Like a Prisoner, and Same Old Blues, all very personal numbers about the relationship between Patty and me. For some time I had been finding it increasingly difficult to find a place to exist in my marriage, and at the same time have a practicing, sober life. The two things weren't really jiving very well. I was going to a lot of meetings and also trying to fit in with our social life, but it was difficult going to dinners because I felt like I was under a microscope. And it was hard, too, for our friends, who were having to moderate their behaviour and act in a way they hadn't had to before. On my return from Montserrat, I chose to hide the fact that I had relapsed by not drinking, and though I managed to do this to begin with, the strain soon became too great. I was doing a lot of fishing, which helped keep me calm, and one evening I was driving home from the river when I saw a pub by the side of the road. It was just getting dark, and I could see through the windows a throng of people drinking and having fun. And at that moment, I had no resistance. My selective memory of what drinking was like told me that standing at the bar in a pub on a summer's evening, with a long tall glass of lager and lime, was heaven, and I chose not to remember the nights on which I had sat with a bottle of vodka, a gram of coke and a shotgun, contemplating suicide. Suddenly I was at the bar ordering a beer, and it did exactly what I thought it would do. Because I hadn't had a drink in a while, it made me quite tipsy, and I drove back to Hurtwood with some difficulty. When I got there, I decided I would tell Patty what I had done and present it as good news, my thinking being that our marriage wasn't working because I was sober, but if I could find a way back into a moderate drinking situation and become a social drinker again like she was, then all of our problems would be solved and she would be happy. I went to find her, and I said, "I've got something to tell you. I had a drink on the way home, and it felt really good, and I think I can control it." Her face fell, and even though I saw the anxiety and disappointment in her expression, I'd already made up my mind that this was the plan. Part of her disappointment was bound up with the fact that a few months previously, Patty and I had visited a fertility clinic after she had told me she was desperate to have a child. Patty's problems in getting pregnant stemmed from a blockage in her fallopian tubes, which had made conceiving a child difficult, if not impossible, during her marriage to George in the days before IVF. During the first years of our marriage it was not discussed, as we were too busy racing through life at breakneck speed. Then on February the 8th, 1984, I noted in my diary, "Nell showed me all the bump she got from the fertility doctor. It seems she is suddenly quite keen to have a child." I had realized that having children was the last thing we had to pursue to hold us together, but I was secretly hoping that it wouldn't work, because, as much as I loved her, I was feeling the need to roam again. I had kind of lost heart. I now set off on a path of attempting controlled social drinking in the way I saw other people do it. I studied them, and for a while my life consisted of going up to the windmill for lunch and having one or two lagers, and then in the evening maybe a glass of wine with dinner, or a scotch after eating. The reality was that, as much as I may have been trying to establish some kind of normal day like other people, what it really amounted to was these two drinking sessions, with me desperately trying to kill the time in between them, often by sleeping all through the afternoon. This schedule was purely alcoholic in its development and focus, and our life just crumbled as a result. On our return from Montserrat, with most of the songs recorded and mixed, Roger, who was happy with the material, sent it off to the record company Warner Brothers, while I set about working on a film score for a new John Hurt movie, The Hit. One of the musicians who helped me with this and played on it was Roger Waters, whom I had known from my youth and whose wife Carolyn was a close friend of Patty's. He played me a cassette of a new album he was working on called The Pros and Cons of Hitchhiking. It had some great players on it, and since I enjoyed his company so much and hanging out with him, I ended up going into the studio with him and working on the album. It was a lot of fun, and at one point I said jokingly, "You should really take this on the road." He then asked me if I'd go with him, and since it was the perfect excuse to run away from my problems at home, I said yes. Roger Forrester was not happy about this, since he didn't like the idea of me being a sideman to anybody, but he reluctantly agreed to let Roger have me on loan. I was, after all, Forrester's property, and I would have to be given back after the tour. The situation between these two was quite funny in that Roger Waters was very suspicious of Roger Forrester, who in turn thought he had Roger Waters figured out. So there was always a lot of sporting banter bouncing back and forth between them, which I think they quite enjoyed. The tour took place in Europe and America during June and July. Roger was working very much to a format, which was multimedia, a combination of visuals and music, both meant to emphasize the story he was telling. I had to wear headphones, as a lot of the music had to be in sync with video on the screen, so I needed to follow a click track, which I'd never done before on stage. I thought it was all pretty interesting, although from where I was standing, I never actually saw any of the video stuff. Probably just as well, as from what I gathered, some very weird stuff was being shown up there. The first night was in Stockholm on June 16th. The gig was great, I noted in my diary. No bad mistakes, and though my own playing could have been better, it wasn't bad at all. Roger was great in front of an audience, quite an eye-opener. I'm back to using Blackie again. It just seems to have that extra bite for stage work, although it's definitely harder to play. Perhaps that's what makes it preferable. The show was like presenting a package, but I became really friendly with the musicians, and we all made the most of it. And as usual, I got involved in some pretty crazy sexual liaisons, ménage à trois and the like, with some scary women, which was all rather sordid. While we were in Canada playing at Maple Leaf Gardens in Toronto, I hit a rock bottom, one of a series that would eventually lead me back to Hazelden. I had been drinking very heavily throughout the tour and had suffered one or two alcoholic breakdowns, like mini-seizures. On this particular occasion I had bought a couple of six-packs of beer, which I drank very quickly, and then I just hit a wall of desperation. It was like a moment of clarity when I saw the absolute squalidness of my life at that moment. I began to write a song called Holy Mother, in which I asked for help from a divine source, a female that I couldn't even begin to identify. I still love that song, because I recognize that it came from deep in my heart as a sincere cry for help. A number of shocks awaited me on my return to England after the Pros and Cons of Hitchhiking tour. The first was that Warner Brothers had sent back the Montserrat tapes, saying the songs weren't strong enough. There weren't enough potential hit singles among them, and we could either re-record the album, removing some of the songs and adding new ones, or find another record company. I was incredibly upset, as this was the first time I'd ever been rejected as a musician. At one point I even equated it with being sober, because one of the first things that had happened to me when I got back from Hazelden was that I got stopped by the police in my car and was breathalyzed, something that had never happened to me while I was drinking. Suddenly, getting a rejection from my record company was just another reflection of all the nastiness one had to face when sober. After my anger subsided, I had the presence of mind to sit down quietly and think what might be the proper action to take. I was partly motivated in this by having heard that Warner had recently dropped Van Morrison, and it occurred to me that if they could drop him, then they could certainly let go of me. And then where would I go? I decided to talk to Roger about it, who had often made sensible decisions in difficult situations, and we both agreed that we should find out what the record company thought hit single material was. They sent me three songs, written by a Texas songwriter they represented named Jerry Lynn Williams, Forever Man, Something's Happening, and See What Love Can Do. And they were good. I loved the way he sang, and I sent back a message to say I would do it, on the condition that they produced the songs and provided the musicians. I think it was, professionally, the first time I'd ever had to back down. I was pretty scared when I went out to L.A., being not quite sure what I was letting myself in for, but as soon as I met him I got on with Jerry Williams like a house on fire. He was an incredible, larger-than-life character who looked like Jack Nicholson and sang like Stevie Wonder. The producers were Ted Templeman and Lenny Waronker, and they brought in what they called the A-team of Jeff Porcaro on drums, Steve Luthacker on guitar, and Michael O'Martin and Greg Fillinganes on synthesizers, all studio musicians who had been used on hit after hit. We recorded these songs, and though I thought the material was pretty good, in the end I believe the original album was better, because it was truer to what we had been trying to do. What I really got out of it was the sheer enjoyment of hanging out with Jerry Williams, though he was hardly the best influence I could have had at the time. He was staying up at Shangri-La, where I had recorded No Reason to Cry, and I went up and stayed there and played on some of his demos. And before I knew it, I was off and running again, with prescription drugs and blow, as well as alcohol. Another piece of shocking news that reached me on my return from the Roger Waters tour was a letter from Yvonne, who wrote to say that she was pregnant and that the baby was mine. She emphasized, however, that she wished to keep this news secret, and that she didn't have any expectations from me. She was married and had decided to try and raise the child within her existing marriage. She had told me that things were not good between her and her husband, and I presumed that she was hoping that the baby might save her marriage. Considering my own behavior, I suppose I should not have been so surprised to find that, during my absence on the road with Roger, Patty had begun an affair with a society photographer. The irony was that he was the brother of Roger's wife, Carolyn, and I later found out from one of my crew, Peter Jackson, that this had been an open secret on the Pros and Cons tour. They had met socially while I was working on the album. I was devastated, but in many subsequent conversations with Patty, it became clear that I had been totally blind to the things that had driven her away from me, namely my chauvinistic behavior and my drinking and depressions. I pleaded with her to come back to me, to no avail, and it was eventually decided that we should have a trial separation. I agreed to rent a flat for her in London, and she moved into an apartment in Devonshire Place. I kept on thinking, I wrote in my diary on October 2, 1984, this can't be happening to me. I was getting ready for an Australian tour, and I was falling to pieces. I spent the mornings in therapy, which helped me, and the afternoons working, which often knocked me back. The problem is that the rehearsals, I wrote, contain all the songs I ever wrote about Patty. And by the time we're finished, I'm back where I started, jealous and rejected. The evenings back at home were the worst. Sad, melancholy, and negative, I wrote. I could not stop brooding about her and her boyfriend, who I considered a complete wimp. One evening, after getting further and further down in my pit, finally I got in the car and drove, with the intention of dragging her back caveman style. She wasn't there, of course. Over the next few weeks, during which I was also rehearsing for the upcoming tour, my state of mind went steadily downhill. I feel so lost and desperate, I wrote on October 12th, and miss her so much that I can't see the way ahead. A week later, I experienced the worst day yet, a complete relapse with all the fears and guilt of the old drinking days. The coke was the worst part of it. Never again. The whole day I spent getting more and more suicidal until finally the phone rang in the evening and it was Roger W., who just by being gentle brought me out of it. I stopped drinking, threw the coke away, and drank glass after glass of water until finally I came back to a feeling of clarity and ease. I must never let this happen again. Two things helped me during this dark period. First and foremost was my music, the one thing that was always there for me. "I want to express all my pain in my music," I wrote in one entry in my diary. "I don't want to stifle it. I want it to reach others in pain, so that they can know they're not alone." I also started to see a brilliant therapist whom Roger Waters had recommended. "I saw Gordon today," I wrote on October 16th, "and he gave me some good insights on both me and the situation. It seems I must use my head to control my emotions or they will destroy me. He is giving me a good foot forward no matter how slow." I wrote and recorded Behind the Sun at Phil's house tonight. It's rough, but it says it all. I intend giving it to Nell on Thursday. This song, which consisted of me on guitar and vocals and Phil on synthesizer, expressed all my feelings of sadness over our breakup. I took the title from a line in Louisiana Blues, one of my favorite Muddy Waters songs, and it became the title track of the new album, released early in 1985. On November 6th, 2 days before leaving for Australia, I had one more meeting with Patty. "I walked and talked with Nell this afternoon. She is lovelier than ever, and I believe she wants to be left alone with her new man and her new life. She said that physically there was no attraction for me anymore, and that she loved being with him. He's a lucky man. And I'm a fool, but I still believe that she loves me, and that I can net her with patience. I can never stop loving her. I have hope and persistence on my side, and I will never give in." Owing to the turmoil I was in, I had avoided further complicating things by involving myself with any other women since my return from America. But the day I flew to Sydney, I went to bed with a girl I had been seeing on and off, named Valentina. It released all kinds of feelings. Valentina made lunch, and we made love. It felt so good to be cared for again. I've been so hungry for so long. But it still doesn't stop the deeper yearning which I keep for my wife. But maybe that too will fade. I pray that she returns before it does. In another hour or so I shall be gone from here and all the ghosts. For me, the Australian tour was not a happy one. Not only was I on an emotional roller coaster, but I was not that happy with the sound we were getting on stage. "The rehearsal was very strange," I recorded on November 12th. "The sound was overpowering, and I felt like I had dropped acid. My confidence is very low." The problem was that Albert Lee was not with us this time around, and his place had been taken by Pete Robinson on synthesizer, an instrument I had got used to in the studio but had some difficulty adjusting to on stage. It seemed to make the show far too loud, which caused problems with my hearing. "I think the frequency of his synth playing could be what causes my deafness," I noted on November 23rd, adding later, "The show was okay for the most part, but toward the end it got too loud again. Deb said for her it was too loud from the word go. It would be great to do one show that was pleasing to everyone." Deb was short for Deborah Russell, a lady I had made friends with in Sydney, and a very fine painter. A week into the tour we were in Sydney when Roger called me to tell me that Nigel Dempster had written up the story of our breakup in his column in the Daily Mail. This really hurt, because it hadn't occurred to me up until that point that it was anyone else's business. "Well, it's over," I wrote. "I spoke to Nell about divorce, and she agrees to it. I've gone back into shock. God help me. I called back in remorse and asked her to come with me to somewhere remote for a week, just to talk it over." 2 days later, I noted, "She has agreed to Florence for a week on the 7th, so I think that will decide it one way or another." I returned to England at the beginning of December 1984, feeling confused and depressed. "On mornings like this," I wrote on my first day back at Hurtwood, "you really need someone to snuggle up to. It's grey and dark and wet and cold. It's England." I decided not to press for a divorce, but to leave it to Patty to ask for one, if and when she decided to. I also wrote a letter to her lover in which I unequivocally stated my feelings. I told him that I hoped he was aware of just what he was doing, because Patty had been the love of my life, and he was succeeding in fucking over everyone. That night, out of the blue, Alice called me from Paris, where she was now living, and lifted my spirits, in fact snapped me out of it by saying that she always knew that Patty would end up with a toff. She suggested that I go to see her in Paris, which did not seem like a good idea. Instead, I pushed Patty, who had been having second thoughts, into agreeing to the Florence trip, which turned into a 3-day disaster. The Florentine experiment proved to be a big letdown, I wrote. The most memorable part was the fact that she has proved, or established, that she finds me sexually repulsive. I was undeterred. My resolve was soon strengthened by the news that my letter to the boyfriend appeared to have paid off, and that he had backed off for a while. So after Christmas, which we spent apart, I decided to press even harder for a reconciliation. Patty would never have considered this without first consulting the committee, as we called the group of close friends she hung out with. Also known as the Blonde Mafia, they were a formidable group of women who used to regularly lunch together and swap gossip. Much to my delight, they gave her the go-ahead, and we flew off together for a holiday in Eilat, Israel. It was just as unsuccessful as the trip to Florence. The problem was that I was convinced that if we could regain the intimate side of our relationship, then everything else would fall into place. So instead of just enjoying her company, I was always trying to push it to the next level. In spite of everything, I persuaded Patty to give me another chance at making our marriage work, and on our return to England she came back to live at Hurtwood. Things did not improve. I had placed her on a pedestal, turning her into a person she could never aspire to be, and that I would only abuse. For most of 1985, apart from August and September, I was out on the road promoting Behind the Sun. In the early part of that summer, I got a phone call from Pete Townsend asking if I would play in a charity event being organized by Bob Geldof to raise money for the victims of famine in Ethiopia. It was to be called Live Aid, and to consist of two concerts to be played simultaneously in London and Philadelphia on July 13th, and broadcast live on TV across the world. As it happened, on that date we were to be in the middle of a North American tour. We were booked to play Las Vegas the night before, with shows in Denver on either side, so there were some pretty big leaps involved. I told Roger to cancel the Las Vegas show and called Pete to say we'd do it. Thank God we were in good shape, with the band playing really well, because had we just started our tour, I might have had second thoughts otherwise. Landing in Philadelphia the day before the show, one couldn't help but get swept up in the atmosphere. The place was just buzzing. The moment we landed, you could feel music everywhere. We checked into the Four Seasons Hotel, every room of which was filled with musicians. It was Music City, and like most people, I was awake most of the night before the concert. I couldn't sleep with nerves. We were due to go on stage in the evening, and I sat watching the performances of the other acts on TV during most of the day, which was probably a psychological mistake, as seeing all these great artists giving their best made me 100 times more psyched up than I would have been for a regular gig. How could I ever match the performance of a band like the Four Tops, with their fantastic big Motown orchestra combined with all their energy? By the time we got out to the stadium, I was in such a state of nerves that I was literally tongue-tied. It was also boiling hot, and the whole band felt faint. In fact, Duck, Dunn, and I later confessed to each other that we'd been close to passing out. The tunnel that we had to walk through from the dressing rooms to the stage was crowded with security, which was unnerving in itself, and things weren't helped by the fact that we had been given different guitar amps from those specified by my roadie, who was subsequently screaming Blue Murder as we reached the stage. To say the whole band was jumpy would be an understatement. As I climbed on stage, I luckily saw the reassuring presence of my old mentor, Ahmet Ertegun, standing in the wings, smiling broadly at me, and giving me a big thumbs-up sign. Things got off to a shaky start. When I moved up to the microphone to sing the first line of White Room, I got a great big shock off it, further unnerving me, a meaning that I had to sing the rest of the show with my mouth not quite touching the mic, but still close enough to hear myself since the monitors weren't very good. We played two more songs, She's Waiting, a song from Behind the Sun, and Layla, and then we were off and it was all over. Phil Collins came on, followed by Led Zeppelin, then Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. After that I remember very little other than being herded back on stage at the end to join in the finale, singing We Are the World. I think I was just in a state of shock. The autumn of 1985 found us touring Italy. From my initial visit there a few years earlier, when I was first exposed to its architecture, fashion, cars and food, I had had a fascination with the country, and its lifestyle in general, but I had never dated an Italian woman. I was telling this to the Italian promoter, who told me that he knew a really interesting girl and that he would introduce us. We were playing a couple of shows in Milan, and after one of them, at dinner, he brought along a strikingly attractive girl named Lori Del Santo. Born in Verona, Lori was the second daughter of a poor Catholic family. When her father died young, she was sent to a convent school to be educated, while her mother worked all hours to make ends meet. As soon as she left school, she made the decision that she would never be poor again. She went to Rome with the intention of making a career in modelling and TV, and by the age of 20 had got parts in various films and sitcoms, and had become the girlfriend of the international arms dealer Adnan Khashoggi. By the time I met her, 7 years later, she was famous throughout Italy as the star of a popular weekly TV show called Drive-In, which was the Italian equivalent of Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. With her long, rich, dark, curly hair, strong bone structure and voluptuous figure, she was a real southern Italian-style beauty. And I was immediately smitten. Laurie had a powerful personality, very confident and flirtatious, and I was flattered by her interest in me. Indeed, the energy between us was very strong, the kind that exists only when you meet someone for the first time. It was also very playful, a quality that had disappeared from my relationship with Patty. When the tour ended, and I went back home to her, we made a further half-hearted attempt to rekindle our marriage, but it didn't really catch. I realized that my attentions had shifted. I had been home just a few days when I suddenly told Patty that I was leaving. I had met somebody in Italy, and I was going to go and stay with her. I was like a flame in the wind, being blown all over the place, with no concern for other people's feelings or for the consequences of my actions. In my mind, I had persuaded myself that, since I had just turned 40, I was going through a midlife crisis, and that was the explanation for everything. I turned up on Laurie's doorstep in Milan, right out of the blue, and told her I'd left Patty, and I was coming to live with her. Funnily enough, it was almost as if she was living an existential life herself, because she didn't bat an eyelid. Her attitude was one of, come and live here, and we'll see where it takes us. It was an extraordinary moment for me, because having actually got there, I just thought to myself, I'm going to start my life again from scratch, here in Italy, without any idea at all of where it is going to go. We lived in Milan for a while, where Laurie was starting a new career as a fashion photographer. She had started doing work for the big fashion houses that were going strong then, like Versace and Armani, and it was through her that I became friendly with the Versace family, particularly with Donatella's husband Paul Beck. I was already a huge fan of Johnny's. I had been buying his things for a while and thought of him as the best tailor in the world. His ideas were revolutionary, but simple at the same time. I loved both Giorgio Armani and Gianni, but at that moment in time, in my opinion, Gianni was the rock and roll tailor. For a while I became Laurie's model and spent quite a lot of time doing shoots with her. As our relationship developed, we began to discuss the possibility of having children together. I told her how I'd always wanted children, but that Patty and I had been unable to conceive. I suggested to Laurie that the two of us would make the most perfect babies. Looking back on it now, it seems like childish nonsense. But at the time, it all made perfect sense. She agreed, and said that she would stop using birth control. The facade crumbled when we were in Rome, where Laurie had another flat. One day she went out and left me on my own, and I started to poke around, which was not a great idea. I opened a cupboard and found a pile of photograph albums, which I took out and started looking through. They were full of pictures of Laurie with famous men. Footballers, actors, politicians, musicians, anyone with any kind of notoriety. I noticed that she struck the same pose in every photograph, wearing the sort of smile that wasn't really a smile at all. I felt like someone had punched me in the stomach. I went icy cold and my hair stood on end. In that moment, I knew we were doomed. However much I might have wanted to walk out at this point, I realized that I had already set in motion something that was out of control, particularly because of the conversation we had had about pregnancy. So I put this experience on file as a reason why the relationship would never last, and started dissembling the whole thing, mentally and emotionally withdrawing. I stayed in Rome for a while, and then we both flew to London and stayed a couple of nights in the Connaught, before moving into an apartment I had organized for us in Berkeley Square. Filled with doubt as I was about my life, both the past and the future, it was a hard time for me. After years of living in the country, I also hated the noise and traffic of the city, so to distract myself, I filled the apartment with recording equipment to enable myself to make demos for my next album. One of the songs I wrote while living there was called Tearing Us Apart, which was about the committee, the group of Patty's friends whom I now blame for coming between us. Your friends are tearing us apart, I wrote. I could think of little else, so it's not surprising that only 2 or 3 weeks after we moved in together, I told Laurie that the relationship just wasn't working for me any more, and that I had to go back to my wife. "That's not good news at all," she said, "because I'm pregnant." At that moment, I couldn't really take this in. I remember getting into my car and driving down to Hurtwood to see Patty, who had been living there since I had left. Somewhere in my alcoholic mind was the idea that she might be waiting for me. When I arrived, it was night time, and there were lights on all over the house. I peered in through the kitchen window and saw Patty and her boyfriend making dinner together. It was like I'd come home to someone else's house. I knocked on the door and said, "I'm back. I'm home." Patty came to the door and said coldly, "You can't come in here right now. This is not the right time." "But this is my home," I said, to which she replied, "No, you can't do this." Suddenly, my world was absolutely in tatters. I was disenchanted with my now pregnant mistress, and I'd lost my wife. I was in conflict and bewildered, and felt like I'd opened a vast door into an empty chasm. At some point during this period, I decided that the only answer to my problems was suicide. I happened to have a full bottle of blue 5-milligram Valium tablets, so I downed them all, the whole bloody lot. I was convinced they would kill me. But astonishingly enough, I woke up 10 hours later, stone-cold sober, and full of the realization of what a lucky escape I'd had. As soon as Laurie came to understand that she could never get me to commit to anything, she went back to Milan, where it was possible for her to make a living. I stayed in England and tried to clear up the mess I'd created by first of all telling Patty about the pregnancy. Considering how much she had longed to have our own child and her deep disappointment at her failure to conceive, it was a dreadful thing to have to tell her. She was utterly devastated, and from then on our life together at Hurtwood was hell. We hacked along for a while, sleeping in different rooms and living pretty much separate lives, until several months later, on her birthday, March 17th, I had a complete meltdown and threw her out of the house. It was a cruel and vicious thing to do, and within a few days I regretted it. I kept replaying our early days over and over in my head, desperately wondering why we couldn't recapture that essence again, but I knew I had crossed a serious barrier this time and that I would have to leave her alone for a while. Patty found a very nice apartment in Kensington and things actually settled down. I visited her once a week and we were quite civil to one another. I stayed out at Hurtwood, doing bits and pieces, drinking in as controlled a manner as I could, but occasionally going on massive benders. It was like being in limbo again, not quite knowing where things were going, or what the outcome of all this would be. Connor. I was sitting at home one day when I received a mysterious phone call from a lady with a strong European accent, who claimed to know all about my marriage difficulties over the years. She also said she knew how to repair them. I was intrigued, as well as angry. How had this person got my number, and where had she got all this inside information that she appeared to know? Soon after, she began to call quite regularly, with bizarre instructions for getting Patty to return, which I followed to the letter, my reasoning being, what have I got to lose? Little did I know what I was getting into. For starters, I had to take a bath in an assortment of herbs, which left me looking like the creature from the Black Lagoon. Gradually, the rituals got more convoluted and very creepy. For example, I had to cut my finger to draw blood, smear it onto a cross with Patty's and my name written on it, and read weird incantations at midnight. Then, of course, with great excitement and expectation, I would call Patty to see if she had changed at all in her demeanour toward me, which, needless to say, never happened. The lady on the phone had a very sympathetic manner and eventually told me that the spell would only work if she could meet me and take the sessions to another level. She lived in New York, where I would be soon, so I agreed to meet her. I knew it was madness, but my rationale was still, what harm can it do? She was an extremely strange-looking woman, quite fat, with bright red hair, and she told me that sex with a virgin would be necessary in order to complete the spell. "Where do you find a virgin in New York?" I replied, and she said, "I'm a virgin." God knows why I didn't just run then. I wish I had, but I was drunk and desperate, and still under the illusion that a reconciliation with Patty would solve everything, so I went through with it. It was humiliating, and I did run.